Yeah, hi. So I wanted to actually start with a little bit of a continuation of what I was talking about yesterday. Then I'll go on to something a bit new. That is, I mentioned yesterday in the name of Reb Chaim that Reb Chaim says there are four basic elements that differentiate the mitzvah of Zechiras Yetzias Mitzrayim from the mitzvah of Sipur. Every single day, twice a day, day and night, there is a mitzvah to remember the Exodus verbally, and that's based on the pasuk Laman Tiskor Yom Seischa Me'eretz Yisrael Kail Yemei Chayecha, and that's discussed in the Haggadah itself, and that is why we say in the Shema, Ani Hashem Elokeichan Asher Hotseisi Yescha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, and even the Art Scroll Siddur will tell you, you have to have Kavana to be fulfilled the mitzvah of Sipur as Chiras Yetzias Mitzrayim. And then there's a special mitzvah the night of the 15th called Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is derived from a totally different pasuk. And the Rambam says both of them are Doraisa. Now there is a question, I'm not going to answer this question in particular, that is, the Rambam does seem to indicate that both Sipur and Zechira are mitzvos min haTorah. But when he lists the 613 mitzvahs in the list, he only lists Sipur. He does not list Zechira. So you have a strange situation, and this happens in a lot of places, actually, in which something could very well be a Doraisa Chiyuv, but for a technical reason, it is not listed in the Minyan HaMitzvahs. Actually, I'll give you one. I'll give you an answer to shame of
pain. Does he list Shema as a...
Yes, he does. Yes, Shema. Well, no, well, not really. Vayomer is not part of Shema. Vayomer got put in there only because of Zechira as he sees the Shema. So there is an answer like Rav Chaim. This is what Rav Chaim says. Rav Chaim says, you know, the Rambam wrote a work called the Sefer HaMitzvot. And the Sefer HaMitzvot is divided into three parts. There is part two is Mitzvot Saseh. And part three is Mitzvot Lo Saseh. And that's fine. But what is part one? Part one is a very, very unique contribution that the Rambam made to the science of halacha, you might say. And that is, the Rambam started off with a very, very difficult problem. And the difficult problem the Rambam has is, Chazal gave us a tradition that there are 613 mitzvot, 248 positive mitzvot, and just 365 negative mitzvot. And the total number is merumas in Torah, Siva, Lanu, Moshe. Torah is Begematria 611. We heard 611 from Moshe, and the first two of the Aseret HaDibros, Anochi, and Lo Yelecha, we heard from God. Okay. Now the problem is, though, Chazal didn't give us a list of what those 613 are. And if you go through every time Hashem said, do something, you're going to get a lot more than 613. You're going to get something like 5,000 imperative statements. Let's take even a single korban. When God says, bring a korban chatas, bring a sin offering. He says, you shall shecht it, you shall sprinkle the blood. In other words, if you start breaking every command down, you know, why don't I count the commandments, don't eat from the Eitz Hadas as the first mitzvah? I mean, it's not on the list of the 613. Okay. So what the Rambam did was, the Rambam was the first, and really almost the only, who tried to develop classification rules. He didn't just list mitzvahs like the Bahag did and Rav Sajagon, but the Rambam tried to first give you 14 principles that determine what do you count and what don't you count. For example, just to give you a simple example, the Rambam said that when a process has multiple steps, we only count the process as a single mitzvah. So the mitzvah is lahavi korban chatas. And that will include shechita and zerika, the sprinkling of the blood, etc. Or Shabbos. Shabbos has 39 malachos. But we don't count Shabbos as 39 prohibitions. Shabbos is one prohibition, and a positive and a negative, lo sasa, bal malach. So the Rambam develops different criteria, and by the way, this is the most lumdish part of the book, meaning The Ramban has many, many disagreements with the Rambam as to the formulations and other mafarshim. This is the most lumdish part of the Sefer HaMitzvos. And the Rambam's listings more or less follow his principles, except when they don't, and that's also all cause for trouble. That sometimes the Rambam's own formulation does not follow the principles he laid down. Okay. So in one of the principles, this is the Shorish, the third Shorish, the Rambam lays down an interesting rule that even if something is a Torah commandment, we only count it as Taryag if it's a mitzvah that is Noheg L'doros, if it is a mitzvah that is supposed to apply in all generations. Now, something can apply in all generations even if it only applies when there's a Beis HaMikdash, because theoretically the Beis HaMikdash could have existed in all generations. But a mitzvah that by its own terms is supposed to expire at a certain time, even if it's a mitzvah, it is not nichnas in taryag. The example the Rambam gives is the Torah prohibits leaving the man over until the morning. That is a negative commandment. But it doesn't apply to our situation because there is no man to be left over. Right? We don't have man anymore. So this is the Rambam's klal, that you only count in Taryag what's called a mitzvah hanoheg l'doros. Okay, this is the Rambam. So now, says Rav Chaim, a beautiful, interesting chat, although theologically it's going to be a very problematical idea. Rav Chaim says the following. We have a machlokes ben Zoma and the Chachamim, and this is in the Haggadah itself, but it's a Mishnah in Brachos. The Torah says, "Oman tiskor es yom, seischa me'eretz Mitzrayim." You shall remember the day that you left Egypt, kol yemei chayecha, all the days of your life. The word kol, everyone remembers that God is still fresh in our memory. Kol is extra. Could have said yemei chayecha. So what is kol coming to include? So Ben Zoma says, yemei chayecha would have meant the days. Kol yemei chayecha teaches me you must even do it at night, even though we didn't leave. That's Ben Zoma. The Chachamim say, no, you don't do it at night. You don't do it at night. But Yomim means in this existence, and Kol means even when Mashiach comes. So you would have thought, what? That the redemption of Mashiach is so great that it'll supersede the Exodus. You still have to mention. So Rav Chaim says, if you learn the Gemara in Brachos, it turns out the following. The reason why Ben Zoma uses the word Kol to be Marbe the night and not Mashiach, because Ben Zoma actually maintains that we are not going to mention the Exodus once Mashiach comes. And this is based on a verse in Sefer Yirmiyahu, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Yirmiyahu, Hine yamim bayim, behold, days are coming, shelo yomar od, people shall no longer say, Chai Hashem, Asher hella escha me'eretz Mitzrayim, you know, Baruch Hashem, who took us out of Mitzrayim. They're not going to bother with that. They're going to say, Chai Hashem, that was Makabetz, the Goliath of Mashiach. So Ben Zoma says to the Chachamim, how can you say we're going to be Maskir Yitzias Mitzrayim Limot HaMashiach? We're Vadai not going to be Maskir, because the miracles of Mashiach will be greater. Therefore, the call of the Torah must be including the night rather than Mashiach. The Chachamim's answer is, no. Yirmiyahu does not mean we're not going to mention Yitzias Mitzrayim at all. It just means it will be secondary to Mashiach. So it turns out, says Rav Chaim, that this is an either-or scenario. If you hold, you say it at night, then you're not going to darshan Limot HaMashiach. If you darshan Limot HaMashiach, you're not going to do it at night. In other words, it's a negative correlation. If Kol is coming for night, you're not Maskir Limot HaMashiach. If Kol is coming for Limot HaMashiach, you're not going to be Maskir at night. So says Rav Chaim, since the Rambam paskins, like Ben Zoma, that you're Mechuyev to be Maskir at night, then the Rambam must understand that you're not going to be Maskir Limot HaMashiach. Therefore, Rav Chaim says, based on the Rambam's own principle in the third Shoresh, that a mitzvah that is not eternal is not counted in the Tayag, according to Ben Zoma, the mitzvah of Zechiras Yetziat Mitzrayim is not an eternal mitzvah. It's a Chiyuv D'Oraisa, but it's not an eternal mitzvah, because it will not apply when Mashiach comes, and that is why, although it is a mitzvah, it is not in the 613 mitzvah.
Sipur will be?
Yeah, now Sipur is, because apparently even when Mashiach comes, on the annual anniversary of the event, we will do Matzah and Korban Pesach, but the daily occurrence will be superseded. This is a Teretz B'Shem Rav Chaim. Now, I don't want to be marichin this too much, I just want to point out that this creates enormous theological problems. You know, the Rambam himself was the formulator of what we know as the 13 fundamental principles of Judaism. Now, the Ani Ma'amin, which is the listing of those 13 principles that in most Siddurim you have after Shacharis, is actually not the Lashon of the Rambam. It's somebody, some anonymous person paraphrased the Rambam. And Yigdal as well. Yigdal is also a song that encapsulates the 13 principles. But the Rambam's 13 principles are his, in the Perush HaMishnayos, in the Hakdoma to the, well, for us it's the 11th Perek of Sanhedrin, Perek Chelek, and the Rambam happens to be the 10th Perek of Sanhedrin, in which the Rambam has an introduction to Olam Haba and Mashiach, and he talks about the principles, right? Kol Yisrael Yeshlam, every Jew has a share in Olam Haba, unless they are a heretic, etc. And the Rambam goes through the definition of an apitoris and a heretic, and he lays down 13 principles. Now, one of the Rambam's 13 principles is the eternity of the Torah. That there is no mitzvah of the Torah that will ever be abrogated or annulled. Now, this is an extraordinarily important principle, because this was one of the main arguments that Judaism had against Islam and Christianity. Because Islam and Christianity acknowledge there was a Maimon Har Sinai, and they acknowledge that God had a covenant with the Jewish people, right? They're not atheistic. They believe everything in the Torah did occur, putting aside some Islamic falsifications like Yishmael at the Al-Qaeda, but by and large. But they claim that this was superseded by an abrogation of the covenant, and in particular the abrogation of the Torah itself, although they may have been false Chiddush more than Yashkes, but whatever it is. And Judaism's response always was Nitzchias HaTorah, eternity of the Torah. Now, there was a sefer written around 150 years after the Rambam, Rav Yosef Alba, great Jewish philosopher, Sefer HaIkarim, and Rav Alba sharply differed with the Rambam. Rav Alba said there are not 13 principles. He said Rav Alba accused the Rambam, or said that the Rambam was combining some things are Ikarim, they're roots, Shirashim, and some are Anafim, branches. So for example, Rav Alba said even something like Mashiach. The Rambam says, if one does not believe in Mashiach, the Rambam says, a person is an apikoris, he is a kofar, he is a heretic, he is not within the faith community of Am Yisrael. Rav Alba said that there are not 13 principles, there's only 3 principles, and everything else are derivative or subsidiary. The 3 principles are, there is a God who created heaven and earth, Metzias Hashem. Principle number 2 is reward and punishment, that God will reward goodness and God will punish evil in some way. And the 3rd principle is revelation, Torah min haShemayim. So let's take Mashiach as an example. According to the Rambam, belief in a physical Mashiach is Ikar Emunah. According to the Rambam, belief in Techiyas HaNesim, physical resurrection, is Ikar Emunah. According to Rav Alba, he doesn't deny Mashiach. Of course he believes in Mashiach, and of course he believes in Techiyas HaNesim. But he said, let's say I'm a Jew, and I believe that God will reward good and punish evil. But I don't believe it'll be through a human Mashiach, or I don't believe in physical resurrection. I only believe in the Neshama, Olam Haba. Rav Alba said, the person is a fool, the person is mistaken, the person is ignorant, but he's not a heretic as long as he has an emuna in sechar v'yonish. That's what Rav Albo means with shirashim, roots versus anafim. Mashiach and Techiyas HaNesim are branches from the root of sechar v'yonish, but they themselves are not shirashim. As opposed to the Rambam, right? The Rambam says very, very clearly, it is an absolute ikar emunah. So people misunderstand Rav Albo. So for example, Rav Albo will bring a lot of mamorim that indicate that that Mashiach doesn't have to come. People sometimes read the book totally wrong. They think Rav Albo didn't believe in Mashiach. Chas v'shalom. Rav Albo is differentiating between stupid beliefs and heretical beliefs. Meaning, Rav Albo was saying, not every mistake a person makes makes a person an apikoros. That's a chiluk that we ought to learn from today as well. Now, in one of the Rambam's principles, eternity of the Torah, Rav Albo also questions that, you know, we see that mitzvos can change. And the outstanding example he brings is Zechiras Yitzias Mitzrayim, that according to Ben Zoma is going to be Batel Limota Mashiach based on the prophet Yirmiyahu. Now, if the Torah itself would have said you're not going to do this in a sermon, that wouldn't have been, I mean, you understand. The problem, the reason why Ben Zoma's rule conflicts with the Rambam's principle is not because it'll expire when Mashiach comes. That alone wouldn't be a problem if the Torah would have said that. But the problem is the Torah doesn't say it expires. It is the prophet Yirmiyahu through prophecy that is giving us that message. And according to the Rambam, it's not possible to allow a later prophet to limit the reach of the Torah. So this is a big kasha. Yeah.
Who says eternity doesn't stop? Basically,
say
it doesn't continue after into the
Moshe Mashiach. Right. So the morale. That's very good. So as I say, so for Rav Chaim to say that the Rambam himself subscribes to the idea that we're not going to be Maskir Limota Mashiach would put the Rambam himself in contradiction with his own principle. But again, there are many, many answers. This is a complicated question. The Maharal himself discusses the question, and one answer the Maharal gives is that eternity of the Torah does not necessarily have to mean forever, ever, ever, but it means in this world. The Biat HaMashiach is called Olam Chadash, Bria Chadasha. And because it's a Bria Chadasha, there may be different rules after Mashiach than before Mashiach, but again, the matter needs much limit. This was kind of just an aside. But what I want to get back to is that the other point Rav Chaim made is, and that is, Zechira is every day, Sipur is once a year, but what is Sipur adding to Zechira? You already have to talk about the Exodus. Had there not been a mitzvah of Sipur, I would have to talk about the Exodus. So Rav Chaim mentioned, you'll recall, four distinctions, Rav Chaim and the Brisker Rav mentioned four distinctions between Sipur and Zechira. Distinction number one is Shelo Tshuva. Leil Seder, it must be a question and an answer process, not just a statement. Number two, Maschil Bignus, begin with the bad and culminate with the good. That's unique to Sipur, not Zechira. Number three, which was I talked about yesterday, the need to explain Pesach Matzah Mora, which is not the rest of the year, it's only Leil Pesach. And number four was added by the Brisker Rav, that the whole year I just remember what Hashem did. Leil Pesach, Chayav Adam, Liros Es Atzmo, I must experience. Alright, so this is important. Rav Chaim says there are four structural features that differentiate Sipur from Zechira. She'ela Utshuva, Maschil Bignus, beginning with the degradation, Pesach Matzamoror, and Chayav Adam, Liros Es Atzmo. So yesterday we explained, at least for a while, the symbolic meanings of Pesach Matzah Mora. Now I just want to briefly add some perspectives on the other elements here. Again, we go with the Balatanya's idea that Mitzrayim has a double meaning. Mitzrayim is, of course, the nation of Egypt that enslaved us. But Mitzrayim also means my limits, my constrictions, my blockages, my Meitzarim, all of those things that prevent me from being connected to Hashem, my sinat chinam, my gaiva, my arrogance, my selfishness, my egotism. Chametz, of course, is a remnant to all of those things. And the Chayav Adam Liros Asasma, the Balatanya says, is you have to identify your inner slavery. And through the Koach of Yitzias Mitzrayim, you can become liberated. So now, let's go back to this idea that the elements tie into this personal journey that a person has to make. Sheila Utshuva. This is very vital. In order for a person to spiritually grow, you have to be a questioner. Now, a questioner means a seeker of knowledge. A person who doesn't say, I am what I am, and I'm not trying to enlarge or expand my horizons. In fact, that's why we say a person that's a great Talmud Chacham. Right? We don't call him a Chacham. We call him a Talmud Chacham. That's a very strange title. You call a Gadol Hador, who knows everything, and you say, what a great Talmud Chacham. Now, Talmud Chacham literally means, actually it's not even clear how to translate it exactly, is Talmud Chacham a wise student? Or is it a student of the wise? There's two ways you can translate even a phrase like that. But the one thing that's for sure is that the highest accolade that we give to a great person in Torah is we call him a Talmid Chacham. Why would I call Rabbi Yashiv a Talmid Chacham? The answer is because the sign of greatness in your life is that you perpetually want to grow. You want to learn. You want to be a Talmid. You know, the story goes, there was a great rabbi, Rabbi Eliezer Silver, who came from Europe around the 1920s. He eventually became primarily Cincinnati. His son was in Harrisburg. Actually, Silver was in Harrisburg himself, but then his son became the rabbi in Harrisburg for many years. But legend has it, maybe a legend, I don't know if it's true, that his first stellar was in a New England city. I don't want to say the name because it's a little bit of Lashon Hara. And he was fired from his first rabbinical position. And the reason he was fired was because the president didn't like the fact that he was learning in the shul at night and wasting electricity. So he said, we don't need a rabbi that's wasting the electric bill.
I had that happen in Louisville.
What? Oh, that's
someone complained.
Somebody complained? Like Shomer Shabbos was, that's open, it's open all night. So when Rabbi Silver said, what do you mean? I'm learning. So the president said, that's even worse. I thought we hired a rabbi who finished his education. We're not here to pay you or, you know, get you through school or whatever it would be. Now, you see how absurd that is. I mean, talk about, I can mention any gadol, any great Talmud Chacham, but I think of Rabbi Yashiv, who, Baruch Hashem, was had a riches yomim until well over 100, and he had been learning yomim v'layla, I don't know, from the age of 5, or whatever the age was, but apparently, after 95 years, 96 years, 98 years, there was still enough to learn, and the like. And therefore, the idea of a question is, I want to know, I want to expand, I want to grow. What I am today doesn't have to limit what I can be tomorrow. What I was yesterday doesn't circumscribe what I become today. The eternal questioner, to always ask, to always, because a question by definition is a desire to keep on going, to keep on learning. And that is really the sign. In fact, even in a secular standpoint, I don't remember the exact quote, but something about the definition of an educator, a person could have many, many degrees, but if he is not interested in continuing to learn, whatever it is, he's not really educated. The definition of an educated person, I saw this as a secular quote, is somebody who still wants to continue to grow. And that is why, in truth, there's really no such thing as a bad question if it is a sincere desire for knowledge. In fact, sometimes in our chinuch systems, I mean, there are difficulties. You know, a child might ask a question, that, you know, how do you know there's a God, whatever it is, and it may be disruptive to the class, or the Rebbe may not have an answer to the question, which is true. I mean, plenty of questions, you know, I don't have answers to, and there may be reasons why it shouldn't be discussed openly. There may be different reasons. But the question process itself is not an illegitimate question if it's done with a sincere desire to learn. Now, of course, there are two types of questions. There are questions with question marks at the end, and there are questions with exclamation points at the end. And those are not really questions. Those are rhetorical, hostile statements. Ravadi Yosef says a very, very simple pshat in the Haggadah. You know, we have the four sons. We have the Chacham, and we have the Rasha. Now, the Chacham asks a very fancy, erudite question. Chukim, Mishpatim, Eidos, he has all the classification systems, which indicates he's scholarly, and he's bright, and he's wise, and he's analytical. And the Rasha says, Ma havoda zos lechem, why are you doing it? Now, the Haggadah is very critical, Philly Chazal, very critical. Lachem says, why do you do it? I don't do it. He's saying, I don't care about this stuff. So we condemn him. We give him like a tough love answer. He says, oh, why do I do it? Because of what God did to me. Meaning with your attitude, you know, you would have been stuck there. So everyone asks the kasha, it's one of the most famous questions, that if the Rasha gets condemned, because he says, Lachem, you, and not me, the Chacham also says, Asher Tziva Hashem Elokeinu Eschem, God commanded you, which is just the historical fact that God gave the commandments to the earlier generation. So why does the Chacham get a free pass on the use of Eschem while the Rasha gets condemned because of the word Lachem? Now there are gazillions of answers to this question. You know, the Chacham says Hashem Elokeinu, he includes. Rav Ovadia says something that's really very, very simple. It says Chaval Da'agada doesn't say those words, and that is, if you look at the words in the Torah immediately preceding the statement, in the case of the Chacham, it says, Ki Yishalcha Bincha Leimor, when your son asks you. In the case of the Rasha, Ki Yomru Aleichem Bineichem, when your son tells you. Now, I wish the Haggadah would have made that point, but Rav Ovadia says, if you look at the Psukim, it's very clear that the real difference between the Rasha and the Chacham is not so much the words that they say, but the attitude behind the words. Are you being hostile? Are you being accusatory? Or do you really want to know? If you really want to know, we find a way to tell you. And by the way, pedagogically, it's a very, you know, Chazal say, Lameid l'shon chalomer eni yodeh. We all should teach ourselves to say we don't know. And you know, if a child asks a parent a question, or a child asks a Rebbe, or a Talmud asks a Rebbe, and the Rebbe says, I don't know, and then, you know, says, let's go try to find out an answer. Let's look up this, and let's look up that. That's a tremendous lesson in and of itself. That does not make the Rebbe, or the parent, look less in the child's eyes. It's the other way around. The child absorbs from that encounter a love of learning and the idea that the Torah is infinite and we keep on trying to grow and we don't reach an age where we say, I don't have to learn anymore. And that itself is, you know, we can impart many, many lessons to children and Talmidim besides the technical information that we give them, certain attitudes towards learning and attitudes towards Torah, etc. So that's something to think about. So that is how Shelo Tshuva connects with a person's personal journey. I remember I was once at a conference with a very, very famous academic who was controversial and kind of loved to talk a lot. So the academic literally said these words. He says, until I was 20, I had to listen. But after 20, I just talked. He says, I don't have to learn from anybody because nobody has anything to teach me. Well, okay. You know, so, yeah.
Had the pleasure and the discomfort of reading a story from one of the children's books, let's say the Hamadiyah, the cartoons. And it shows a picture of a young boy, perhaps between 5 and 8. He decided he would remove himself from the Seder and go sit outside on the steps. And why was he sitting on the steps? He was out desperately waiting for Eliyahu HaNavi.
Right.
Did you read this?
I did not.
Oh, okay. And his parents called him in, and at a certain point, he was crying. He said he never came. What do I do? How can I accept this? How does a parent answer that?
Yeah. Well, you know, those are very, very hard questions. You know, how do we answer it to ourselves? You know, like someone asked Rebecca Kamenevsky, what do I tell my children about the Holocaust? And Rebecca said, well, what do you tell yourself about the Holocaust? Meaning, we have problems. But I think, you know, child can cry in yomtiv, but you know, if a parent comes and cries with the child, say, you know, we are crying that we don't have Mashiach yet, that life is so difficult, there's so many sorrows from Israel, and we hope and pray that Mashiach will come. You know, and the son sees, the child sees, that we feel the same thing. These are not illegitimate feelings. I mean, for kids, kama v'kama gedel, how many times have Chafetz Chaim shed tears that Mashiach is not here? That's a high madrega. The child is a very chashuv, very, very high level. Okay, so that's how the Shelo Tshuva fits into getting rid of your Mitzvah, going beyond your boundaries, going beyond our comfort level, as it were. All of us become, you know, without getting into too many controversial issues here, there is sometimes a difference between what you might call religious and spiritual. A person's religious and a person keeps mitzvahs, and that's very, very important. Of course it's very important. That's the foundation of our connection to God. But we sometimes do it mechanically, rote. We don't seek to expand our horizons, deepen our understandings. It becomes, as the Navi said, this is obviously a very old problem because the Nevi'im talked about it, mitzvat anashim milimata, doing things out of rote. Questions, bedafka breaks that habit. That question is, I want to go on, I want to go weiter, I want to go further. Okay. Now we then come to the second element of Rav Chaim, beginning with the bad. Right? It's not enough to talk about the good. You got to begin with the bad. And so Machlokes is the bad we're talking about, the bad of slavery, Avodim Ayinu. Is it the bad that we were Avodah Zorah? But you got to begin with the bad. Now, and this is Li'ikuvah, meaning, if you were to conduct a Pesach Seder, and you would only talk about the miracles and the redemptions, and you wouldn't talk about how bad the slavery was, you would not be Yotzei the Mitzvah. You got to begin with the bad. Why is that so? So there are two explanations. The first explanation is very simple, but very true. The Rambam offers it. The Rambam simply says, it is human nature that we appreciate blessing only when we've been through the opposite. This is human nature. We appreciate health very often. Only if, God forbid, we've been through sickness or we've lost our health, then we appreciate health. That is why people that are Holocaust survivors or people who have come from oppressed countries tend to be much more patriotic when they come to a free society, whether it's the United States or whether it's Israel or, you know, any country that has liberty. If you were born in a free country, you know, you don't feel it so much. It's the nature of a person. In fact, the Chovas HaLevavos uses this as a famous mashal. The Chovas HaLevavos says, imagine if you were born in India in rampant poverty, and you were starved and you were beaten, and one day a benefactor comes and takes you to a country and gives you luxuries and all the food that you want and all the comfort that you want, how much gratitude you would feel. But Nebuch, if you were born in that very environment and you never went through, you should actually be more grateful. And yet, we take it for granted. So the Rambam says, Pashut, in order to feel the gift of Hashem redeeming, I need to think and imagine how bad the slavery was. So according to the Rambam, it's a before and after picture. That's why you have to be Maschul Dignus and Messiah Bishvach. But there is a kasha on that understanding. Because it is HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself that decreed we would have to go through the hardship. I mean, the example would be, let's imagine I threw you in jail. And then I released you earlier than I told you I was sentencing you for. Are you going to be grateful to me for releasing you? Or are you going to say, why did you put me in jail to begin with? Meaning, it was Hashem that decreed the avdus. How can that be a basis of gratitude? So because of this, the Sifrei Chassidus say, there is a deeper yesod in Maschil Bignus and Messiah Bishvach. It's not remember the bad so you appreciate the good, but to understand that even in the bad, even in the negativity, even in the adversity, there are hidden lights of redemption for which to be grateful. In other words, Yetzias Mitzrayim didn't simply restore us to the antecedent situation that we were. It's not that we were free, we were slaves, we were free. If that's all it did, we would have resentment. Why did I go through that? But rather, the freedom that we got after the slavery was qualitatively different than what we had before. Now, how is that so? So, there are many, many perspectives on this, but one perspective is that we know that Chazal say that the Jewish people in Mitzrayim, although they were in the 49th level of Tumah, they didn't change their names, they didn't change their language, they kept a certain sense of unity and cohesiveness. The Beis Halevi raises an interesting question. How can Chazal say they kept achdus and cohesiveness? There is a medrash that says, right, there is a medrash that says that when Paro died, I'm sorry, when Yosef died, the Shvatim and their descendants said, if we were so matzliach and so successful in Egyptian society, when we were keeping distinct minhagim, why don't we become more and more like the Mitzrayim? And they will love us more, and we will be accepted even more. So the Medrash says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sent an evil Paro who did not remember Yosef or anything that Yosef did to prevent the Jewish people from trying to assimilate into Egyptian culture. So the Beis Halevi says, which one was it? Were the Jewish people assimilating or were they remaining distinct? The Beis Halevi says, they were in the process of assimilation. And it was precisely the persecution of the Mitzrayim that made them realize we will never be accepted. And the Beis Halevi goes through, as many, many Sfarim have done, many Rabbanim have done over the years, many Gedolim have done over the years, that when Jews want to become too close to the values of a non-Jewish culture, the non-Jewish culture will spit them out as if to tell them, if you don't realize that you have to be different or distinct or unique, we will make you realize that. And this was a gift. The slavery of Mitzrayim, as difficult as it was, gave us a sense of achdus, of unity, of distinction. Right? What did Bilam say when Bilam tried to curse us? And Hashem changed the curse of Bilam into a bracha. Hein am levadot. They are a nation that stands alone. Now this is the eternal conflict of the Jewish people. Soloveitchik used to connect it to the pasuk when Avram said, Ger v'toshav, right? Avram said to Ephraim in Chevron, when he had to buy the Marat HaMachpelah to Barry Sora. So Avram prefaced it with a statement, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. I am a stranger and a resident. And in some ways, it's a contradiction. A ger, yeah, it doesn't mean convert over there. It means ger, I'm a stranger. I really don't belong here. And Rav Soloveitchik used to say that this is the eternal dichotomy of the Jew. On one hand, we are a toshav. We live wherever we live. And we contribute. Our Jews are not like, I don't want to get into any group libeling, but they're not like cultures that simply create their own enclaves and are not involved in society at all. We contribute. We add value to any society that we're in. We care about the welfare of all. But at the same time, a Jew also has to feel like a ger, that this is not my true place. Right? So, therefore, the Beis Halevi says that one of the blessings of slavery was it gave us that sense that we have to be different. And that was a bracha. There's a second aspect. The Torah says more than 30 times you have to love the ger, the one who converts to Judaism. Love the ger. And in one of the psukim it says, love and take care of the ger. Ki gerin hayisem v'yaretz Mitzrayim. Now here, even though ger means a convert, but obviously it doesn't mean because you were converts in Mitzrayim. You have to go back to the meaning, the literal meaning of ger is stranger. A non-Jew who converts to Judaism came to a culture which was foreign to them. They had no relatives, they had no connection, they had no property. They were on the bottom of the totem pole. What is the Torah telling the Jewish people? When you're ensconced in your land, you're comfortable, you're powerful, you're wealthy, and you have people of insignificance, or seemingly insignificance, who come to you, don't treat them like riffraff or garbage. Remember, you were once like that. You were slaves. Remember your suffering. Remember your humiliation. Remember your embarrassment, and use it as the key to empathy and compassion for those who are suffering. Psychologically, this is a remarkably profound statement. Because when people have been through in their life, you know, we live in a society, Western society generally, where everybody is a victim of one thing or another. In fact, even lawyers in the United States are trying to create a special protected group, like hate crimes. You know, like you have blacks and Asians. So lawyers are, you know, we are victims of hate crimes because society looks at us in such a low way. Now, when a person deals with pain, there are two ways they can deal with it. One way is they develop an inner shell of toughness in which they will never allow themselves to be hurt again. You know, and all of their strengths, so to speak, are turned into developing a protective shell so they will not get hurt. And they want to distance themselves from the pain. The Torah is suggesting, now sometimes that is necessary, sometimes it is necessary, but the Torah is suggesting that the real way a person deals with psychological pain, abuse, negativity, is by not forgetting it, but connecting to it, remembering what the feelings were like, and using that as the source of empathy and compassion and concern and rachamim. Remember the friendless scare, because you were once that person. It's not an I versus them. That person was me, and therefore I look at him the way I would look at myself. So this is a gift. Again, it's an awesome gift. It's a gift that comes from persecution and the like. And the truth of the matter is, again, I don't want to get too political, even when Jews wander very, very far from the Torah, it is often this value, distorted, misused, misapplied, abused, that leads them to make the political decisions people make. Why are so many Jews involved in democratic, liberal politics? Part of it is the belief, again, I'm not going to address the merits of it, that one party is more compassionate than the other. And Jews are compassionate people. Why were so many Jews involved in the very, very wrong turn called communism? It came, right, from a real desire to help the oppressed. Even in East, I live right on the boundary of East Jerusalem, Highway 1, or Sameach is in the center of the action, so to speak. And every Friday we see people who are demonstrating for a pretty crazy, crazy cause of different rights of Palestinian terrorists or whatever it would be. And of course, this is a shtus for hevel, and you know, very destructive and demoralizing. And I'm not, please don't assume that I'm defending that. I denounce it and I'm against it. But I will say that it comes from a certain feeling within a Jewish soul, even if it's distorted and even if it's being applied in the wrong place, that when people in the world are suffering in any way, I want to stand up. Again, it's a Jewish value that gets perverted, but it still emanates from the Jewish heart. And therefore, you see the inner meaning, going back to the main point. The yesod of maschil bignus umisayem bishvach is not remember the bad so that you appreciate the good, but rather to see in the adversities of life the redemptive potentials. To see that even in the so-called bad, there is so much I can learn and grow from those experiences. And therefore, in a sense, I take the darkness of the past and I reframe it as the basis of my connection to God. It's like you put a different frame on it, a different view. You actually redefine the past as a source of positivity, a source of strength. And the truth of the matter is, if this is the general lesson of Maskil Bignas, this is a lesson that applies to our lives as individuals as well. Many of you may know or have heard of Rabbi Seth and Sherry Mandel. If you remember the story, that their son Kobe was actually the Kernel of Bracha, Hashem Yinkum Dama, was actually a very good friend of my son. And a number of years ago, he and the classmates were brutally murdered in Tekoa by some heroic big shot that took two 12-year-old boys and rammed their skulls with sharp rocks until they both died. It takes a lot of courage to do something like that. And one can imagine, maybe we can't imagine, what the Mandels felt like. I mean, Baruch Hashem, they had to have other children, but still such a tragedy. Sherry told me she could not get out of her mind what her son was experiencing those last minutes. Again, the one thing I told her, which may be a drop in the bucket of comfort, is the Shalah HaKadosh writes that when someone is murdered al Kiddush Hashem, they do not feel pain as their neshama goes back to their creator. But be it as it may, one could understand that on some level they literally lost the desire to live, to be consumed with so much grief. And yet we know that what they did was, eventually, they turned their grief into a tool for helping hundreds, if not thousands, of families. They established a foundation in memory of Kobe, and that provides, you know, financial, psychological aid to families that have been victimized by terrorism. They have summer camps and retreats. Sherry herself has written two books about living with a broken heart. This is a guy, really, I mean, I cannot say it better than her, how taking the adversity and the greatest tragedy of their life and turning it into a source of light and a source of hope. And of course, unfortunately, it's not unique in Eretz Yisrael, especially if you look at the three families that lost their children in Gaza and the message that they gave us and the tragedies after that. I mean, we should see less and less of it, but unfortunately, we have so many examples of people who take the most difficult situations that a human being can go through, and instead of being broken by it, they grow from it and they become sources of inspiration. Now, if you would ask them, would you prefer the other way? Well, of course, we would have preferred the other way. Hashem, for reasons we don't understand, didn't do it the other way. But given the reality of what is put into our lives, what do we choose to do with it? Rav Soloveitchik used to put it this way. The issue of why do bad things happen to good people? Theodicy. Sadek Faralo. Russia Vatovla. Rav Soloveitchik used to say, this cannot be approached as a theological question. It can only be approached as a halachic question. What does he mean by that? Theology asks, why did God do this? He says, that's an unanswerable question. Moshe asked Hashem. And Hashem said, V'chanosi, Eis asher achon, I have grace, do I want to be gracious to? V'richamti, Eis asher arachem, meaning, I'm not telling you, Moshe. The book of Eov, big, big book, hard book, goes to all of this, but if you go to the end of the book, you actually see there is no answer. So Rav Soloveitchik says, to ask the question in terms of why God did something, the Holocaust, terrorism, whatever it is, we don't know. But Halacha does not try to explain God. Halacha asks the question, what is my responsibility at any given moment in time? And for that, there is a meaningful answer. When a person is faced with all sorts of difficulties, a person asks, how can I take the darkness and make it light? How can I take the chaos and make it something of beauty? How can I grow from this? How can I help others? What can I do, as it were, to redeem the tragedy and somehow make meaning out of madness? That's a halachic. Again, he doesn't mean halacha in the sense of the narrow word halacha, but halachic in the sense of what is my obligation, as opposed to why God allowed something to happen. That is the idea of maschilin b'gnosu masayim b'shvach. I'll just end with two stories that illustrate this. One involves a non-religious man, although he happens to be Jewish. I'm not sure if he's still alive anymore. There was a famous, or maybe there is a famous, classical pianist, Leon Fleischer. And in the 60s and 70s, he was really one of the most famous pianists in the world. Very, very, very successful. But what happened was that he began to notice a repetitive stress injury in which he was not able to manipulate his fingers that well. And he went all over the world looking for treatments and nothing worked. And as a result, he had to give up playing. And, Baruch Hashem, it's not terrorism, it's not death, but for a musician of his caliber, this was very, very traumatic. And in fact, he wanted to commit suicide, he said later. But eventually he got over it, and he basically said, if he cannot be a teacher, I'm sorry, if he cannot be a musician, he can at least be a teacher. And he got into a second career in the Peabody Institute in Baltimore, a very famous musical conservatory. He became one of the preeminent teachers of piano in the world, and many of the next generation of the great pianists are his proteges and the like. Which is, okay, that's very, very nice. And he did this for around 25 years. After 25 years, his wife read that there's a new therapy being developed in Japan for deep tissue massage or whatever it is. And she wanted him to try it out. And he didn't want to do it. He said, listen, I don't want to get my hopes up. I've gotten used to this. I'm happy with this. If I get my hopes up that I'll go back to performing and it doesn't happen, I'm going to get suicidal again. But she convinced him. And lo and behold, a miracle happened that he was able to play, and he played, I think, for another 5 years. I think he came back eventually, but he got 5 years of playing in. Now, it's a nice story, but why am I telling you this? I'm telling you this because of something that he himself said afterwards. And again, he's not an observant Jew, but you see that the neshama of a Jew has such a holiness and connection with God. He said that when I was a performer, my life was all about me. What brought me glory? What brought me recognition? I lived for the applause. I lived for the acclaim of others. But God said, you're arrogant. You're conceited. I want you to learn to care about another person. I want you to rejoice in another person's successes. So I'm taking away your talent. And I'm forcing you to devote your life to making others look good. And Fleischer said, and that's what happened over many years, I began to rejoice in the successes of these students as much as my own success. And their triumphs were my triumphs. And their failures were my failures. And I cared about them even more than I cared about myself. And then God said, you've learned your lesson. You can have back your talents. Now, this is a neat story in the sense that it has an arc, albeit a 25-year arc. Many of our stories, many of our tragedies, may have a longer arc. We don't necessarily see the good end at the end. But we believe as a matter of emunah that even in those dark moments, there is redemptive potential. I'll end with another story. Many of you probably have heard of Rav Yaakov Yosef Herman, who was Rabbi Scheinberg's father, Rebbetzin Scheinberg's father, and Ruchama Shein, again, Zichron Aluf Racha, wrote a very, very great biography of her father called All for the Boss, Akol the Adon Akol in Hebrew, and it's filled with all sorts of interesting stories of what an amazing person he was. But one of the stories she tells about her father is that he came with his parents to the United States in the early 1900s. And his parents could not make a living here. So they went back to Europe and they left him alone in the United States. He was not even bar mitzvah yet. This is the way things were. I mean, this is not the only case. I mean, we can't even imagine those types of scenarios where little children were effectively left to fend. This is before there were child labor laws. take care. So the first thing that happened was that Friday afternoon, his landlord raised the rent from $5 a month to $10 a month. And the kid couldn't afford it. He didn't have $10 a month to pay rent. So he was evicted Friday afternoon from this whatever room he was staying in. And he spent that first Friday night, this is the week his parents left, in Central Park. All he had were two little rolls with him. And he spent the night in Central Park. Now, Central Park was safer then than it later became, although now after Giuliani, Central Park is actually relatively safe and comparatively safe. And he was cold. He was afraid. He was frightened. He had no family. And what's going to happen next week? He'll get a job, and if you weren't to Shomer Shabbos, you likely lost the job next week anyway. He didn't know what he was going to do. He just didn't know what will happen to his life, what will happen to him. And that night, he prayed to Hashem the following. He said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, please God, if you give me Parnasa, and eventually if I have a Shidduch who's even thinking that I have a family and I'm Zocha, that to establish a life, please don't let me forget all the feelings I have this night. Please let me remember what it's like to be cold and lonely and poor and friendless, so that when I encounter other people who are in that situation, I will remember what they went through. So what he asked God was, he should never forget the pain that he has. And if you know the rest of the book, you know that Baruch Hashem eventually, although he lost it in the Depression, but at least he became a successful businessman. He became fairly wealthy, well-established. And, of course, he spent many years in Eretz Yisrael afterwards. But the years of his prosperity and even the years of his poverty, he and his Rebbetzin always had many, many people over. And, of course, Baruch Hashem, he had his share of Gedolim and Rosh Hashivas. He was one of the few homes that the great Rosh Hashivas of Europe would be willing to eat at. But he didn't just have chashuv with great people. He had many, many people who stayed for months at a time, who were homeless, who were mentally deranged, who were abusive, people that we would not enjoy in our own homes. Someone once poured hot cholent over him more than one time. They didn't like the food or whatever it was. And when someone said to him, how can you live with these crazy people? Why do you allow them to come into your home and stay for weeks or months at a time? He said he knows what they are feeling because he felt that way himself. And he asked Hashem to never let him forget the feelings of that night. And he says, and that gave him the source of his rachamim and compassion for all the people that were not necessarily the nicest, greatest people that we would like in our own home. So, b'kitzur, this is the yesod of maschil b'gnus u'mesayim b'shvach. Not simply remember the bad so that you appreciate the good, but to see even in the adversity the source of your rachamim and compassion and care for others, in which you can redeem tragedy even. You redeem the tragedy by reframing it, by redefining it, by using it as a positive source to achieve something in life that one would not have achieved without it. This is a very, very high madrega, and certainly we ask Hashem to spare us these difficulties, because who says we will rise to the occasion? That's a real question. But nevertheless, the potential is there, and Hashem's gifts sometimes come in terrifying, horrifying ways, to be sure. But within the horror and even the terror, there are going to be gifts that we have to look for in one way or the other to find some type of meaning in the difficulties of life. So, again, more than a simcha.